From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org. WNYC On Demand is supported by Open from American Express, presenting the interactive webcast event, Making a Name for Yourself. Kate and Andy Spade and Bobby Brown discuss their leap from business to brand, created by Open from American Express. Registration at openforumonline.com.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is out this week. I'm Bob Garfield. As the ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah took hold this week, the U.S. press looked to call the fight, much like commentators of a boxing match, trying to determine which bloodied fighter won by decision.
And a new claim of victory by Hezbollah's leader.
The head of Hezbollah defiantly was claiming victory today.
It's a major defeat because Israel failed
well,
to
did
break
either
Hezbollah.
Side win in these 5 weeks of fighting?
First of all, I if I were Hezbollah, I'd be claiming victory too.
Meanwhile, the boxers stumbled back to their metaphorical corners and waved their exhausted arms, trying to rally the crowd. Israel dropped leaflets on decimated neighborhoods, blaming the destruction on Hezbollah's reckless actions, while Hezbollah passed out flyers congratulating Shiites on their victory, even as they were returning home to rubble. The Israeli government urged its citizens to download special software to help reverse what it sees as increasingly negative online coverage of Israel, alerting users to respond to online polls and critical articles. But anti-Israeli activists got the same message and began using the software to counter the pro-Israel comments. Israel even hacked into the broadcast signal of Al-Manar, Hezbollah's TV channel, and overlaid images of dead Hezbollah fighters. Middle East historian Mark Levine isn't shocked by the rush to spin things, but with Israel's particular tactics, he was surprised.
What's striking to me is that actually people thought this would work, and that people would suddenly pick up a flyer amidst the rubble of their house and say, oh, yes, it's Hezbollah's fault for causing this, not Israel's fault for dropping a bomb. I don't know of many times in history when this has worked, and the fact that today, in this day and age, with such a sophisticated media understanding that even the most uneducated person has, that governments would actually go to this level to think that this could help in winning this kind of war between Hezbollah and Israel is quite stunning.
Are you equating these techniques with, for example, Tokyo Rose, the name the Allied forces in the South Pacific gave to female Japanese propagandists during World War II?
Well, I can only say that of all the Lebanese people I've spoken with, I don't think very many Lebanese, if any, had changed their minds about who was at fault here and who was really responsible. So in terms of spinning this war, which Hezbollah was clearly doing from the moment it kidnapped the Israeli soldiers, I have to say that Israel's attempts to spin this war are certainly quite primitive.
How would you value the images immediately after the hostilities of Hezbollah members only days before armed gunmen out manning bulldozers and so forth and cleaning up the rubble?
I think this is the most priceless image of the war for Hezbollah. For many years now, the Bush administration has talked about the idea of creative destruction as the best way to remake the Middle East in our image. In other words, we need to destroy the old systems, even using violence if necessary, as in Iraq or Afghanistan, to help build something new. The problem is we've been very creative in what we've destroyed, but not so creative in how to rebuild. And I think Hassan Nasrallah has suddenly learned this idea of creative destruction much better than we did, much better than even Israel's idea of creating a new Middle East out of the ashes of the old, because the second the fighting died down, his men started rebuilding. And therefore, for his constituents, they can now feel, even though I've suffered collectively, it was worth it. So he's creating a sense of collective unity.
The press, particularly in the Arab world, have been referring to Lebanon as the Sixth War, a reference to the previous wars between the Arabs and Israel. But It hasn't really taken hold in the West. What's the significance of calling this the Sixth War?
Calling it the Sixth War, first of all, gives it a level of credibility that it might not otherwise have had, because the other Arab-Israeli wars were wars of many, at least several Arab states, against one country, Israel. This has been a war that's been between the State of Israel and the guerrilla movement in a neighboring country. To raise it to the stature of all the other wars, which are so ingrained in Arab culture, right, and especially because so many of them were wars that they were defeated, this in some ways creates a psychological counterbalance that allows people to think that finally we have managed to beat or at least stand up to Israel, even if the we is utterly fictitious. And that's, of course, one of the things that the media is good at, is making people who have nothing to do with an event actually feel they are somehow part of it. So I think the Arab media and all the other countries that have nothing to do with this war are trying to appropriate it and make it their own victory, even though ostensibly it had nothing to do with them and was probably done in spite of them.
What are the stakes here? What is this spinning meant to accomplish?
I think if we're asking how the way the conflict is being mediated now, how the media images are helping to shift and settle the terrain for, let's say, the next 6 months, and will that put in place a new order or trends that will continue for the next 5 or 10 years and really be engraved into the world's historical narrative of these events? I think yes. I think the way this is playing out right now is going to have very long-term consequences. I think the way that Hezbollah has been able to transition so quickly from a fighting force back into a civilian and social force is delegitimizing almost every state in the region, because they cannot do that even when they haven't fought a war. When there's an earthquake in Cairo, it's never the Egyptian government that can help the victims. It's usually the Muslim Brotherhood. It's just proving once again to people around the Muslim world that it is the social movements on the grassroots that are there for them, not the oppressive states. And that's the narrative that has traveled through this war and is going to come out the other end.
Mark, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mark Levine is a professor of modern Middle Eastern history, culture, and Islamic studies at University of California, Irvine. His new book, Heavy Metal Islam, will be published by Random House next spring. Michael Young is the opinion editor of the Lebanon Daily Star. He also has been tracking public perceptions of the war, but he says Hezbollah is far from convincing the Lebanese that they've won anything.
The idea that the party has gained popularity is, I'm afraid, one of these propaganda pieces that has come out and that seems to have spread, particularly in the Western media. I can assure you that from my observations in the last month or so, from talking to political leaders, from talking to people all around, this is simply incorrect. I mean, yes, among some segments of the population, there was admiration for the fight it put up in the South, certainly. Israel is not popular. But you would be surprised at how much within the Sunni community, within the Christian community, within the Druze community, there was a great deal of anger with how the party had taken Lebanon into a completely unnecessary, pointless, destructive war.
Tell me about the arc of the press coverage and the editorial opinion in Beirut, for example, during the course of the war.
Hezbollah, from the beginning of the war, kept a very tight lid on information. We don't know how many losses they've taken. I've heard anecdotally that they've lost a few hundred combatants, 300-400. The Israelis say 500. The fact of the matter is, we have to guess. The only source of information in South Lebanon was Hezbollah and the UNIFIL, the United Nations force. But the UNIFIL was not able to get around. The foreign media in Beirut, when they wanted to go to the southern suburbs, they were taken there by Hezbollah. What I noticed was that in the media, there was a special effort by all the channels to show those in Lebanon who were critical of Hezbollah, but also to give a lot of space to those defending Hezbollah. But I think many people, when they went on talk shows, when they went on to the news and they spoke about Hezbollah, they tended to adopt Hezbollah's position out of fear of some kind of retaliation. And I think it's only towards the end that you began to see the criticism level rising more.
Threats against those who speak out against Hezbollah are not necessarily empty ones. There have been assassinations in the past of political figures and journalists.
Well, I mean, we don't know if Hezbollah was involved in any of these assassinations or bombings. It was more the Syrians who were accused of this. But Hezbollah, while it has not reacted in a violent way up to now, and it may indeed never do so, it's not the kind of organization, and the Shiite community is not in a mood today where one can say, absolutely, there's nothing to fear if you criticize the party. They read everything. And even in a time not of war, but of peace, they could be quite spirited in their response to criticism directed against them. Let me bring you to one particular incident. Hassan Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, in, I believe it was the second week of the war, went on Al Jazeera and had an interview. And at the end of the interview, before closing, he essentially threatened those people in Lebanon who were not on his side, as he put it. And he said, there will be repercussions at the end of the war. We may be forgiving, or we may not be.
On the question of who won this war, in Lebanon, as we've discussed, it's not altogether clear. In Israel, there is probably no consensus, but there is an enormous amount of criticism about the way the war was prosecuted and about how it ended up. And yet elsewhere in the Arab and Muslim worlds, the press seems pretty much unanimous that it was a great historic victory, that Israel was finally put in its place and proven not to be militarily omnipotent. Is anyone in Lebanon reacting to the consensus elsewhere in the Arab and Muslim worlds that this was a huge triumph?
The fact that the Arabs are praising this shows you how miserably the Arabs have performed in past wars in the Middle East. And we are looking at the Israeli press now, many people read it in Beirut, and indeed there is within Israel great criticism of the military establishment. But the fact is that the vast majority of Lebanese, we look around us and we say, well, if this is what Israel did on a bad day, you know, it knocked us from $6 to $10 billion back, it ruined our road system. Hundreds of thousands of Lebanese now and in the future probably will emigrate because they don't really feel there's a future in the country. If Israel can do that on a bad day, what can it do on a good day? And I do recognize Hezbollah fought well in the south against the Israelis, but one does not measure victory in that way.
All right, Michael. Well, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Michael Young is the opinion editor at the Daily Star in Lebanon. His latest piece in the U.S. media was in last Sunday's New York Times Magazine titled Hezbollah's Other War. Coming up, getting news out of Cuba is very difficult. And getting American propaganda into Cuba is even harder. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Over the past several months, we've been following the patchwork of lawsuits challenging wiretapping by the National Security Agency. On Thursday, one of those legal challenges scored a significant victory when a federal judge in Detroit ruled against the Bush administration, deeming the NSA program unconstitutional and ordering it to stop at once. The case was brought by the American Civil Liberties Union on behalf of a group of journalists, lawyers, scholars, and nonprofit organizations who argued that the possibility of having their international calls wiretapped was hampering their work. Many legal scholars were skeptical as to whether the journalists had cause or standing because they had no actual proof that their calls had been tapped. But the judge sided with the reporters. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez has already announced that the Justice Department will appeal. Jonathan Turley is a professor of public interest law at George Washington University and a lead counsel in another federal case also challenging the NSA program. Jonathan, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
What does this decision say?
Well, the decision takes the White House out to the shed on almost every point. The court found that the operation is just clearly unconstitutional, that the president has been acting unlawfully for years in ordering warrantless domestic surveillance.
Now, there have been a number of these suits filed at various courts around the country with respect to the NSA program. This one was particularly interesting to us because among the complainants are journalists who say that just the very idea that an overseas news source could be being eavesdropped on has a chilling effect on the process of journalism. Do you think that argument had any place in the judge's decision, or was this strictly about the constitutionality of eavesdropping in general?
Well, ironically, I think this was the least likely case to find this program unconstitutional. There were many questions about standing and whether these types of claims really could sustain a challenge against an intelligence operation. But it really did become the sleeper. And ultimately, this judge found that there was sufficient standing to get to the merits. But the case primarily focused on the operation itself. The court did not view this as a particularly close question. Now, the implications of that are pretty significant because if the Court of Appeals agrees with this decision, it means that the president didn't just simply act unlawfully. Under the statute, violations of this kind are defined as federal crimes. So if this is upheld, there is a strong argument that the president committed a federal crime not once, but maybe over 30 times.
Now, the Attorney General has made clear he's going to appeal this case. Assuming for a moment that the judge in Detroit agrees to stay the ruling pending the outcome of that appeal, what happens if, in fact, the decision is upheld on appeal and winds up in this heavily polarized Supreme Court? What do you expect would happen there?
Well, first of all, a loss in the Sixth Circuit would be very stinging because this is not viewed as a liberal circuit. It's actually a circuit that has been very deferential to the president. But they will no doubt go to the Supreme Court, and it's a better court for them. They have Sam Alito on the court, and he is renowned for his deference to the executive. I mean, it's virtually blind deference. And so they can count on his vote and Thomas's vote, Chief Justice Roberts' vote. But the problem is they just lost the Guantanamo Bay case. And that case really rejected the legal claims made for the NSA operation. And so a majority on the court has already told this White House, you're going too far.
Alberto Gonzalez has been claiming all along that, don't worry, we have sufficient legal justification under Congress's mandate to carry on these programs, but we can't tell you what they are because if we did, we'd have to kill you. As a legal scholar, are you not just dying to find out what those legal justifications are?
Well, it really is par for the course with this administration that we really do have something that will give us the authority, but it's locked in this closet and just trust us, we're the government. The problem for Alberto Gonzalez is that there really is nothing in the closet that is going to be relevant. On this point, I think the judge in Detroit was absolutely right. What she said was, I know what I need to know. That is, I know that you have never been given this authority by Congress. I know that citizens have these constitutional rights that cannot be abridged. And I know that you did not get a warrant for this surveillance. And that's what is the most relevant thing. Now, you may have information that you're pursuing bin Laden or that you've stopped some attack, but that doesn't go into the constitutional analysis. You first have to show that you have authority, not just a reason to act.
Okay, Jonathan. As always, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
Jonathan Turley is a professor of public interest law at George Washington University. About 3 weeks ago, the Cuban government announced that President Fidel Castro was in the hospital and that he'd handed over power to his brother pending his recovery. But since then, the Cuban government has released next to nothing about Castro's condition and essentially shut off the island to foreign journalists. So how do you cover a huge breaking story when you're not even allowed into the country? We asked Dan Gretsch, correspondent for American Public Media's Marketplace, to find out.
For years, the Miami Herald has been essentially banned from reporting in Cuba. The Cuban government considers the paper a mouthpiece of Miami's Cuban exile community, and therefore an enemy of the revolution. But Cuba is the foreign story that most interests Herald readers, so the papers found ways around the reporting ban.
I intentionally left my computer. I intentionally left my press badge and all my cards.
That's a Miami Herald staff writer who recently posed as a tourist to report from Cuba. On the Media has agreed not to disclose his identity because he might be sneaking back onto the island sometime soon. Over the years, the Miami Herald has compiled a running list of do's and don'ts for reporting undercover from the communist island.
Try not to draw attention to yourself. Take lots of cash. Stay away from other reporters. Obviously, it's just about being very discreet. Of course, looking back on it now, I probably could have done a lot of things differently.
The Herald reporter was on the island for 5 days. He contributed to several stories and wrote a front-page piece about how Cubans were watching foreign news programs through illegal satellite hookups. He used public payphones and internet cafes to send back his dispatches, and his name never appeared with the stories. But the cat-and-mouse game soon ended.
I got a knock on my hotel room door around 6 in the evening, and it was two uniformed men. They said, "We heard you've been doing some journalism work, and you're on a tourist visa. You're not allowed to do that." But they were very nice. They said, "Excuse us for the inconvenience," and they took my passport, and they said, "Stay in the hotel. Your flight's tomorrow, and we'll come pick you up."
It's not always been this hard to report from Cuba. In 1998, during Pope John Paul II's visit, the government threw open the doors to 2,000 journalists, half of them from the U.S. Despite the embargo, the U.S. government allows American journalists to report from Cuba. But when the Cuban government announced Castro was in the hospital, it got hundreds of applications for press visas and turned them all down. A German news agency estimated 150 journalists were turned away at José Martí International Airport in Havana in the days following the announcement. One of them was Eugene Robinson, a Washington Post columnist who wrote a book on Cuban music called Last Dance in Havana. He tried to enter as a tourist, but got caught at customs.
The immigration officer scans my passport in, and then there's a change in his facial expression, which I recognized as not a good thing. He started asking questions and eventually got to the magic question, which is, "Are you a journalist, sir?" That's a question that we have to answer truthfully. So I said, "Yes, I am."
Robinson and journalists from Spain, the Netherlands, and Panama spent the night in the airport. They were shipped out of the country the next day. Cuba's recent clampdown on journalists creates a dilemma for media organizations. Do you stretch the truth to get your reporter in the country? Or do you abide by Cuba's laws and potentially shut yourself out of a big story? New York Times deputy foreign editor Ethan Bronner.
There are conflicting issues, but on balance, it's more important to be there than to not break the law, that particular law in Cuba.
The Times sent in veteran Mexico City correspondent Ginger Thompson. On August 4th, she contributed reporting to a page one story by Juan Ferrero about the ties between Cuba and Venezuela. This tagline ran at the end of the piece. An employee of the New York Times who could not be named for security reasons contributed reporting from Havana for this article.
The point we were trying to make is that our reporter would be at risk of arrest and or expulsion if named.
The use of the phrase security reasons surprised some journalists. Several mainstream news organizations, including America's three major TV networks, have had unofficial reporters on the ground for years. And The Washington Post's Eugene Robinson says there's no history of Cuban authorities jailing foreign journalists.
The real reason is because we don't want the Cubans to know who it is and find them and kick them out. And I don't think you can really encapsulate that as security concerns.
I think it was just infelicitous phrasing, you know, that was put together at 7 o'clock on a workday evening.
Bronner says the tagline won't be used again.
in retrospect, I think I would have deprived the readers of that bit of information because it probably tipped the authorities in Cuba off to Ginger's presence there.
Ginger Thompson was kicked out after 7 days. While that might be the worst a foreign reporter faces for breaking Cuba's rules, the risks are much greater for their sources. Gary Marks is the Havana correspondent for the Chicago Tribune.
Yesterday, the individual I was interviewing was a guy on the street. He was selling cigarettes on the street. I'm surrounded by three or four police officers. And what do I do? Do I try to walk away? So I talk to the individual I'm interviewing. I say, do you want me to stay here to try to protect you? And he says, no, you know, you got to go. He says, you know, nothing's going to happen to me now, but maybe tomorrow they're going to take me away.
The Chicago Tribune is one of four U.S. news organizations that have government-approved bureaus in Havana. The others are CNN, the Associated Press, and the South Florida Sun Sentinel. If you haven't heard of the Sun Sentinel, they're based in Fort Lauderdale, and they're the main competitor to the Miami Herald. Sun Sentinel editor Earl Mawker explains how his paper landed this coveted bureau, its only foreign posting.
There's a variety of reasons. The obvious one is that we're not the Miami Herald.
When Castro fell sick, the Sun Sentinel was in between correspondents, and they couldn't get their reporter back in the country. They didn't dare sneak a reporter in as a tourist for fear of having their bureau taken away. So in an ironic turn, Castro's nemesis, the Miami Herald, had a reporter on the ground in Cuba while the Sun Sentinel's Havana bureau sat empty. For On the Media, I'm Dan Gretsch.
While American journalists work to get the story out of Cuba, the American government is trying to get its story in. Its vehicles are Radio Martí and TV Martí, stations that carry a mix of news and entertainment shows produced in Florida and designed to show Cubans why their government is bad for them. Last week, the leadership handover was front and center on TV Martí's satire show, The Office of the Chief. In the chair normally occupied by Fidel was Raúl Castro, waxing about his 59 luxury homes and barking orders at his staff.
Speaking of lobster, Adela, go find me some lunch. Just like it's fixed for my brother. With the finest ham, cold lobster with mayonnaise. And don't forget, also whiskey.
Thank you, General. Listen, do you prefer that I use the slogan Fatherland or Death or Always Towards Victory?
No, I prefer Black Label.
The Cuban government isn't laughing. For years, it's insisted the penetration of their airwaves violates international law. But the real joke may be on the Americans, because while the U.S. has spent close to $500 million on TV and Radio Martí, the Cuban government has managed to effectively block the transmission signal, at least on the TV side. Viewership on the island is estimated to be a third of 1%. One study several years ago found that 9 out of 10 Cubans had never even heard of the channel. John Nichols is a communications professor at Penn State University and a longtime critic of the stations. He joins us now. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
I gather that the model is Radio Free Europe, but one thing about Radio Free Europe is that, you know, by most accounts, I think that while it was a propaganda channel for the United States government, the news was presented in an unpoliticized way, I guess, under the theory that just the access to the outside world was, you know, a sufficient enticement for the imprisoned populace of the Eastern Bloc. Can the same be said of the broadcasts going into Cuba?
Well, there's no question that the radio and TV Martí broadcasts are highly politicized and have become even more so in recent years. When the station was first established, it was in Washington and it was under some significant U.S. government control. In recent years, they've moved the operations to Miami and it's truly become captive of the shrill Cuban exile community. And of course, the people still on the island, they're not idiots. They figure this out quite quickly, and that's part of the reason why the audience has dropped like a stone. When Radio Martí first went on the air, Cubans tuned in fairly large numbers. And then after the novelty wore off and they got an idea about the ideological position and the hostile nature of the broadcast, then they tuned out.
Well, you know, here's another possible explanation for the low listenership. If you get caught listening to Radio and TV Marti or any other foreign broadcast in Cuba, you could be in a whole lot of trouble, no?
Well, it's definitely frowned upon. There's no question about that. But the Cuban people are not as isolated as you might think. I mean, there are all sorts of other news sources that are available to them, and they take advantage of it without any penalty by the government. I mean, they could receive broadcasts from Mexico. They could receive broadcasts from the Dominican Republic. There's a fair number of shortwave receivers on the island. They listen to the BBC from London and so on. So it does not follow just because the Cuban people don't find the Castro-dominated media system on the island to be credible. It doesn't automatically follow that they therefore will embrace the voice of the Cuban exile community in South Florida.
So in response to the overwhelming success of the project and the jamming by the Cuban government, the United States has just appropriated another $10 million on top of the $27 million annual budget for these two operations for an airplane that is supposed to fly nearer to the Cuban coast and therefore to defeat the jamming of the TV signal. How in the world did they get that $10 million at a time when everything else in the budget is being cut way back?
The Cuban exile community that are strong advocates for these stations and which populate most of the positions at the station, the Cuban exile community is the largest voting bloc in the state of Florida, which is a swing state, which has decided one of the last presidential elections. And so it has very little to do with Cuba and U.S.-Cuban relations and has a great deal to do with currying favor with a domestic political constituency.
Well, apart from full employment for Cuban exiles in the broadcast business, has Radio or TV Marti done anything positive by your lights?
Positive. Well, the only thing that it really has accomplished is that it's complicated the relationship between the United States and Cuba. And I mean, if the unstated intent of TV Marti is to raise the level of conflict between the two countries, then it's been very successful, even though TV Marti is not seen on the island.
Okay, John, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob.
John Nichols is a professor of communications at Penn State University. Coming up, prostitution, Hollywood style, and the fine art of reading movie blurbs. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield with a few of your letters. Last week, in a story about two lobbyists who received classified information from a Pentagon analyst and who have since been criminally charged for sharing that information with the press, I referred to AIPAC as the American-Israel Political Action Committee. Dave Travass from Texas wrote in to correct me. This is completely wrong, he writes, and is actually a smear against the organization. The actual name is the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. The name and the organization predate the concept of political action committees, also known as PACs. Since PACs are well known to be involved in political corruption, he goes on to say, you essentially connect the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee with groups as sleazy as Tom DeLay's Trim PAC and Arm PAC. Ruth Smith had a different gripe with the AIPAC story. She wasn't sure that the implications of the charges were so harrowing. Quote, please forgive me if I'm not quaking in my First Amendment boots when I hear that journalists might actually be prosecuted for revealing classified information that may be damaging to the country. If they don't like the restraints on the disclosure of this type of information, they might try to ply their trade in Iran or Saudi Arabia. More than one reader perceived holes in our analysis last week of a Scripps Howard poll, which found that 36% of Americans believe the government to have been complicit in the 9/11 attacks. Jim Flood from Brooklyn writes that one cause may be the way in which the government has, quote, manipulated 9/11 imagery and the American people's fear of terrorism to achieve political goals. For example, preventing a post-Democratic convention bounce for John Kerry by announcing an orange alert the day after the convention, based on old intelligence about a negligible and non-immediate threat. Betsy Beckman asks, did I somehow miss in your analysis of both issues the assertion or discussion of one very obvious central cause? The American media has shamefully avoided any truly incisive criticism of Bush administration policies and propaganda from 9/11 on, extending to coverage of Afghanistan, our misadventures in Iraq, and any number of sloppy extensions of the, quote, war on terror. Keep your letters, comments, and conspiracy theories coming to onthemedia@wnyc.org, and don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. Expense paid, two-night stay at a luxury hotel with free round-trip airfare, spending money, and even a private screening of the latest Hollywood movie. Sounds like a game show giveaway. And it sort of is. Only the game here is celebrity journalism, and the show is the press junket. Last month, freelance film critic Eric Snyder attended a junket in Seattle for Oliver Stone's World Trade Center. He recounted the story on his blog, ericdsnyder.com. He's here to talk about the experience and the fallout. Eric, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you for having me.
So you get flown out there. You're in this extraordinary hotel. You even get a per diem for meals.
Right.
What does the studio expect in return?
The unspoken expectation, I guess, is that you'll go back to wherever you come from and you'll write one of those fluffy celebrity interview stories that you see in your local paper. You know, I sat down with Oliver Stone and here's what he said about his movie. Not a review necessarily, but, you know, an article that sort of gets people talking about this movie.
You did not provide a puff piece. In fact, your column, which was, by the way, very funny.
Thank you.
Was a complete evisceration of the process and of the behavior of the journalists and the behavior of even some of the celebrities. I mean, you were quite harsh on Maggie Gyllenhaal for her comportment during the thing and even her looks.
I did take an unfair swipe at her appearance, yes.
Why don't you give me the low lights?
As far as specifics at this one, there was one of the guys there who actually lives in Seattle, but who had stayed in the hotel the night before anyway. That struck me as sort of over the top as far as taking freebies goes. I noticed that most of the other writers there, they referred to the celebrities by their first names, which reminded me of the way paparazzi behave. And they only talked about movies in the context of who's in them and can we interview them. There was very little discussion at all about whether movies are any good. You know, the whole system is kind of unsettling, and I think it operates on darkness. It operates on both sides sort of lying to themselves, where the studios pretend that they're not buying off writers, and writers pretend they're not being bought off. So just kind of talking about that in general is kind of against what they want.
What was the reaction from Paramount?
They weren't happy with it. And I expected not to be invited on any more junkets, which would be fine because I didn't intend to go on anymore. But they took it a step further and banned me from all their press screenings.
And they asked you to remove your post from your website.
And I said, well, no.
Now, I want to talk about something else that happened in the aftermath here. You actually went back and checked one of the other journalists' copy that came out of this press junket, and you found something pretty astonishing. Tell me about that.
Yes, one of the other writers on the junket had been Tim Nasson, who writes for a site called wildaboutmovies.com. He's out of Boston. And as I was transcribing my recording of the interview with Oliver Stone, we'd had a roundtable interview with him, me and Tim Nasson and several others. I went to Tim's site and read his article on the interview, and I noticed that all the quotes that he had were not actual quotes. That's not what Oliver Stone said. That's not what Maggie Gyllenhaal said. He hadn't changed their ideas any. He had just sort of paraphrased them and put quotation marks around it. So I wrote to him. I gave him the benefit of the doubt and said, you know, I don't know what your background is, but you can't do that in journalism. And so, you know, my unsolicited advice would be to take the article down or to go back to your tape of the interview and put the actual direct quotes in. He replied by saying that he'd interviewed everyone, not just in Seattle with me, but he'd also interviewed them previously in New York, and that that must be why the quotes were different. The quotes came from those interviews. So I looked at his article again. I thought, okay, that's possible, I guess. But then I noticed a chunk in his article where he says something, blah, 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 said Oliver Stone, sitting in Hotel 1000 in Seattle. And I said, aha.
That's the smoking gun.
That's the smoking gun, yes. I was at that interview at Hotel 1000 in Seattle. That's not what Stone said.
But as far as you know, Paramount didn't object to that because whether or not it was shoddy journalism, it didn't bring disrepute on Paramount or World Trade Center or Oliver Stone.
Exactly, yeah. It was still warm and fluffy, which is what they paid for, so why would they care?
Okay, now finally, since you have set yourself up to be an ethics policeman here, I have to call your attention to the fact that you were once fired a few years back for a pretty gross ethical breach.
Well, that story, in a nutshell, there was a local theater that was doing a production of a Neil Simon play, and I knew this particular play had a lot of profanity in it, and I assumed they were going to cut the profanity out, which was the common practice in community theater. And I wondered if that was actually legal as far as the royalties and the copyrights were concerned. So I called the Samuel French Company, which handles the royalties, not as a reporter, just as a curious person, and asked. And they said, no, it's not allowed. And in fact, they already knew about this particular offense and that they were going to deal with it. And sure enough, a few weeks later, the theater announced that they were canceling the show because they had been told either to do it with the swear words or don't do it at all. And so I was asked by the city editor at the paper that I worked for to write the news story about this show being canceled. And I ought to have said at that point, you know, I wasn't the one who got the show shut down, but I did call Samuel French and I did have some contact prior, so we should probably have someone else write the story or at least mention, you know, that this reporter had some previous contact with Samuel French. I didn't do that. And so the way it looked to my bosses was that I had started the fire and then written a story about this mysterious arsonist.
So from just about every aspect of this, you seem to be a kind of an expert on journalistic transparency. What conclusions can we draw from the entirety of your career?
Well, one, that there's apparently never a dull moment. You know, as far as the thing 3 years ago with the paper, not that I was, you know, made a practice of being an unethical journalist before, but it was sort of a wake-up call of, you know, you've got to take this kind of thing seriously. And so I don't know if I'm a crusader now for ethics in journalism, but now I'm sort of ever more interested in the whole journalism world being represented well by its practitioners.
Eric, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been an honor.
Eric Snyder is a freelance film critic whose movie reviews appear in Portland, Oregon's Willamette Week and the City Weekly of Salt Lake City. He also blogs, pretty hilariously, at ericdsnyder.com. Film marketing, of course, doesn't end with junkets. What comes next in the process is the ad campaign, but journalists figure in them, too. Almost every ad for almost every movie includes a few endorsements attributed to one or more film critics, a process often requiring as much imagination and editing as the movie itself. A few years back, we examined the phenomenon. Fair warning, by few, I mean five, so some of the details are a bit dated, but otherwise, absolutely nothing has changed. A few months back, New York Times film critic Elvis Mitchell screened the movie 15 Minutes for which he wrote a complex, ambivalent review. He credited the film for storytelling impact, but ultimately dismissed it for trading in the very cynical manipulation it purports to expose. Curiously, considering his generally negative tone, the movie ads for 15 minutes quoted Mitchell. Not the part of his review that said, big turnoff, but the part that said, fleet-footed, merciless entertainment. Mitchell was a little surprised.
I never thought of merciless as being a compliment unless you were Genghis Khan, but, you know, I don't work for a movie studio.
That was not exactly an isolated incident. Andrew Johnston, writing about the flop Baby Geniuses in Us Weekly, compared the film unfavorably to 101 Dalmatians. The 101 Dalmatians part made it to the cover of the Video Box. The unfavorably, needless to say, did not. And the Sacramento Bee's Joe Baltocchi saw a movie called Next Friday that provoked him to use the word shameless in his review. Not masterful, not transcendent, shameless. It showed up in the ads as if it were a superlative. Welcome to the world of movie marketing, a fifth dimension of context wherein critics' words or phrases are cut, pasted, trimmed, rearranged, and generally defiled in the name of suggesting journalistic endorsement, whether real or imagined. Elvis Mitchell.
They're put together like ransom notes, you know, a word at a time.
Aris Christofidis operates the website critics.com.
Studio PR people, they seem to be the masters of the ellipses. The best one this year, it's from a DVD of a movie called Immortality. And the quote in the bag is, in quotation marks, Jude Law, ellipses, terrific. Film.com. Now, I went to film.com and tried to find if there was a review of Immortality, and there isn't. What they did was simply to take the name Jude Law and take the terrific out of a review of a movie that Jude Law was involved in and simply put it on the DVD box, and there you have it.
So, yeah, when you see extremely brief bursts of apparent gusto attributed to name-brand critics, it's safe to assume they've been printed out of context, almost always with one or more exclamation points appended to suggest even more critical enthusiasm. Exclamations, Mitchell assures, never show up in actual reviews, unless meant ironically.
Outside of the Marvel comics of the 1960s, when Spider-Man, even with his thoughts, had exclamation points at the end of them, no, I don't know anybody who uses exclamation points.
Of course, most often, if you read the fine print, you're apt to discover that the critics quoted are not from the New York Times of the world. They're from the KMAX TV Channel 31 Sacramentos of the world. Andrew Johnston of Us calls them quote machines, seduced by free junkets to studio events where they get to briefly interview stars in exchange for fulsome blurb material. But the movie ads print the raves in big type and the source in fine print, elevating the obscure to Ebertian status. Andrew Johnston.
There are, you know, people from, you know, small market TV stations who are willing to just, like, basically say whatever the studio wants them to say to get their name in the paper.
And if just the right words don't spring to mind, no worries. The studios apparently are happy to provide those as well. Tim Gray follows the blurb wars for Daily Variety.
The funny thing is the quotes keep staying the same. The names keep changing, but you'll always see, you know, funny, funny, funny. You will never forget, fill in the name of the movie. You know, the most fun you'll have this summer. You know, all those quotes, they keep reappearing every year.
A lot of them are attributed to a particularly ubiquitous blurbographer by the name of Jeff Craig of a mysterious media outlet called 60 Second Preview. Craig is quoted everywhere, and he is always deliriously excited about the movie. He loved Cheryl Ladd in Permanent Midnight. Free Willy 3 was breathtaking. The Kevin Pollak Cheryl Lee Ralph vehicle titled Deterrence wasn't one of the top 10 of the year. It was one of the most important films of our time. Now there's a movie lover. So we naturally wanted to speak to him, but we couldn't find 60 Second Preview, not any trace of it. Anywhere we looked, we don't even know what medium it is.
I have no idea who he is. I have no idea what he does. I have no idea where he's published, if he's published somewhere. It's a great mystery.
Critic.com's Aris Christofidis.
He's very enthusiastic. There is no doubt about that. Anybody that enthusiastic has to be alive.
We had the same difficulty finding a movie studio interested in discussing this topic. We called six of them, and they all declined to answer questions about blurbation. But if the studios have created this parallel universe of irrational exuberance, that doesn't mean there are no natural forces working in their favor. between the grotesquely twisted, ellipses-filled, exclamation-appended cut-and-paste blurb and the bought-and-paid-for quid pro quo of blurb whoredom, there is the just-plain-friendly practitioner, Variety's Tim Gray.
There's a guy named Lou Luminick at the New York Post who last year in March called What Planet Are You From? The funniest movie of the year, and then a few months later called Best in Show, the year's funniest movie. You figure, all right, it's 6 months have passed. It's like, yeah, that's enough. That counts as a year.
Lou Luminick, are you a soft touch?
Not to my knowledge. I mean, I basically like movies. You know, there are different kinds of critics. I mean, there are critics who are basically focused on nitpicking and tearing movies apart. I mean, I'm working for a tabloid. I'm basically doing a consumer guide. I mean, is the film worth going to see or not?
Luminick also acknowledges sometimes getting a kick out of seeing himself quoted here and there. To him, it's a minor bonus. To Owen Gleiberman, who reviews films for Entertainment Weekly, that little thrill is quite sinister, a sort of ego payola pervading the trade, fundamentally skewing the judgment of even the most established critics.
It's vanity. When you see a quote of yours in a movie ad, it can make you feel important. It shouldn't, because it doesn't make you important. But there are people who really get off on it. And it can
well, how about you, Owen Gleiberman? Have you ever gotten a little charge or even a big one?
Yes, I've gotten the charge. I'll admit it.
For the record, Elvis Mitchell of the New York Times unequivocally denies any ego satisfaction out of being cited, which he sees as merely a byproduct of his labors.
The blurb is just, well, what's the negative of gravy? Whatever that would be, that's what a blurb is.
In any event, next time you plunk down $8 to see the feel-good hit of the summer, make sure you've read the fine print, extrapolated to account for the ellipses, and most of all, considered the source. You might also want to make sure it isn't still June. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, Mike Volo, and Mark Phillips, and edited this week pretty much by committee. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had more help from Noah Kuman. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by Ciaobella Gelato, purveyors of all natural gelato and sorbet. Ciaobella is available nationwide at specialty food markets. More information at ciaobellagelato.com or 1-800-GELATO-3. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at wnyc.org. And thanks.